Good morning. Welcome to the Eastman Financial Report. I'm Dan Eastman, your host. Today is Thursday, October 12th, 2023, and I would like to welcome you to the Eastman Financial Report and also to WVW-TV. We're very thankful to be able to broadcast on this network. It's a great network. It's been around a long time, since I think 2006. And one of the hallmarks of our efforts is that we're able to bring different and thought-provoking viewpoints to the marketplace of ideas. And we're very, very pleased that you've chosen to join us today, or at least this half hour, to listen to the Eastman Financial Report. As you know, we're not a commercial network. We don't sell advertising. We are a sponsored network. And it's through the generosity of kind viewers such as yourselves and our sponsors that keep us broadcasting this vital information worldwide. You notice there's no paywall or no subscription. There's no annual fees. You're able to listen to us free of charge 24/7. And that happens because of people who support our efforts here at WVW-TV. The sponsor of my show, of course, is Swiss America Trading, which is a, as I like to say, a fine purveyor of precious metals. It's an American company based in Arizona. And they may make a metal, make a market in precious, tangible precious metals. So if you're interested in adding tangible, which means you can hold it in your hand, if you wanted to add precious metals to your individual portfolio and you're looking for a partner or vendor in that space, certainly Swiss America Trading would be an excellent choice. And we'd like to thank them for sponsoring this, not only the network, but my program. And if you're interested in information, you can give them a call at 1-800-519-6271. And ask them to send you some free information. And if you'd like to go on their website, SwissAmerica.com, you can shop around and see what they have to offer. And if you use the promo code EASTMAN, which stands for Eastman Financial Report, they will be very happy to send you some free information. And of course, you can transact business right on their account, very private, and they'll send your purchases directly to you. They are running a special right now that you should know about. They are offering a $0.50 silver coin, a bullion coin, for $13.50, and that includes shipping to your home or business. And that's a great deal. If you watch the price of silver going up and down, you'll realize that if you can get yourself some silver for $13.50 and free shipping, that's a bargain. And there's a limit on that. There's 250 coins per person. And of course, the offer expires when they run out of inventory. So if you're thinking about gift giving for the holidays and stocking stuffers and all of those things, you might consider looking at a gift of precious metals. It's something that we've done in our family from time to time, and it's certainly a gift that that will be kept for a long time because it's very, very precious. That's why they call it precious metals. So anyway, give Swiss America a call, 1-800-519-6271, or go to the website, use the promo code Eastman, and ask them about that $13.50 special that includes shipping, because it's a great time, and as long as the inventory supply lasts, you can take advantage of a bargain. So give them a call. Okay, I want to talk about the big news today. And of course, the biggest news, of course, is the very unstable situation in the Middle East, especially in Israel right now. We are well into Thursday of this week. It's been about the better part of a week of absorbing the shock and horror of this brutal attack on the Israeli citizens and Israel, the nation of Israel. And of course, all of the fist shaking and anger and all of the reactions around the world. And of course, that has a real focusing effect on that situation. And of course, there's other news. You know, it's kind of interesting how nobody's talking about Ukraine today, or nobody's talking about a lot of the other global news, because everybody's attention shifts over here to watch this situation unfold. It's a really difficult situation. And of course, the political haymakers in Washington are wasting no time and, you know, gaining traction in political hay. And that's almost kind of a sad thing to watch. I've been watching some of the better known and more intellectual commentators that are in the space commenting, and there are cool heads that prevail, and of course there's the flaming hair crowd that wants to go nuclear, and it's all a destabilizing situation. Of course, we don't look at, I suspect it would be cold-hearted to be more concerned about the economy than the disaster and human carnage in the Middle East. I mean, this is a people problem. And, of course, you have to recognize that first and foremost. But there are economic ripples that happen. And, of course, this is a financial show, not a political show. We're going to look at the financial ripples. But it's not to say we are diminishing the human suffering and cost by any inch at all. I mean, we are first and foremost cognizant of the human disaster unfolding, and we're keeping all the people in our prayers because it's a very difficult time. And obviously, history is an ongoing thing. You know, today's events are tomorrow's history, but that's a difficult situation. And I think as Israel reestablishes itself, its sovereignty reaffirms its sovereignty, and puts in protective measures, and then deals with these perpetrators, that's going to take some time, and it's going to make a lot of news. But let's talk about some of the blowback from the perspective of the economy. And one of the things, of course, we're looking at is the international global market for petroleum. And that has been first and foremost a problem since World War II. If you think about what the world looked like in World War II and before World War II, and then in the aftermath of the total destruction of Western Europe and Eastern Europe, you realize that automotive transportation is a relatively new phenomenon. Before World War II, it was not uncommon in rural areas to see horse-drawn wagons. And horse-drawn wagons have been around since the caveman days. I mean, it's just been the way people transported. You had the choice of walking or pulling your own wagon, or hitching your wagon to a horse or an ox or maybe a goat or whatever. It's some form of motive propulsion that would make your life easier if you could connect your wagon to something rather than you have to pull it yourself. And of course, that's how the world modernized. So as automobiles became sort of they were invented in the early 1900s, late 1800s, if you take Mercedes-Benz at their word, which we do, then effectively the first half of the 20th century was automobiles as somewhat of a novelty and a luxury. But by the time World War II happened, the modern, you know, we started out with the Model T Ford, which was Henry Ford's idea of putting a motorized cart under every person. It was sort of like an early concept of a Volkswagen, people's car. And of course, after the war, when the American economy was geared up for production to fight two fronts in a war and manufacturing automobiles, the American economy was first out of the chute with basically mobilizing the entire population. Cars became not so much a curiosity or a luxury, they became a necessity. And personal transportation took off. The interstate highway systems were funded by the federal government. And lo and behold, America became motorized. And then, of course, Europe, as it was climbing out of the rubble, motorized. And, of course, Japan, as it was climbing out of the rubble, motorized. And that was pretty much it. You went to the rest of the world, and you might see some trucks pulling stuff, but the idea of humans transporting themselves, individuals transporting themselves, is a very, very rare thing to see. And in many places in Asia, I was in China not that long ago, within the last 15 years, and it was on the cusp of individual mobilization. It was amazing how you were actually seeing the phenomenon of a rural agrarian society emerging into a society that had motorization individuals. And it was quite fascinating to watch because the rules of the road were not quite as refined as they are in the US and Europe. But the point is that we have a global growing motor individual mobilization world. And if you look now, China with 1.5 plus billion people, everybody wants a car. And who can blame them? Everybody, we all have cars. We have multiple cars. We like cars. So we have, add another 1.5 billion cars. And then, of course, if you look at India, you will see the same phenomena happening. The Indian population, and apparently now India is now the largest population. They've surpassed China. Well, that's another, let's say, 1.6 billion people. So you get basically 3 plus billion new consumers for automobiles. So if you're in the automobile business, this is a great time to be in that space. And the problem that we have is, of course, automobiles work on oil. And this is kind of an interesting period in history, because when you think about all of us, and this is, we all know this. We all go to the gas station, we fill up our cars with gasoline, and off we go. We don't think twice about it. It's a little bit of an inconvenience. Oh, I'm out of gas. You pull in 5 minutes later, or maybe 10 minutes at the most, you're probably 8 minutes. You fill up your tank, you drive off, you don't even think about it. And you put your car in the machine, in the gas pump, and maybe you run in for a Red Bull or something, but you basically don't think much about it at all, other than it's a slight pause in your daily routine. And that takes an ocean of oil to make that, because as we all know, oil is in the ground. And of course, some people say it's fossil fuels. These are leftover dinosaurs and stuff that's turned into goo under the ground, and you pump up the goo and you do some chemistry to it, and then you get gasoline, and then you can fill your car and drive off. Well, it's a lot more complicated than that. I remember back in the 1970s, the story was that gasoline or oil was a finite resource, and it was made out of plants and dinosaurs and this and that, way underground. I don't know how they all got underground, but they were all down there somewhere and dig these deep holes, and then all this leftover dinosaurs would blow up through the hole and we'd make gas out of it. Well, what we've learned since the 1970s, and keep in mind that's 50 years ago, that it's a much more complicated thing. And of course, there's all sorts of theories out there that underneath the earth, the whole center of the earth is full of oil. When we burn it all up, the Earth's going to float away or something. I probably aren't going to live long enough to see that. I kind of hope I don't. But at the end of the day, oil is a big deal. And my point in this mini lecture is it's not just the United States with our 330 million people. We never looked at America as being a small country. We think of America as vast, a huge continent, the biggest country, most powerful, biggest economy. But the reality is, in today's world, we are a small country. 330 million versus 3 billion, we are one tenth of that. And that's just two countries. And then you add, Europe, that's another billion, however you define Europe. You start to realize that the global market for oil has changed dramatically. And this is my point. It's changed dramatically since the 1970s. Well, back in the 70s, those of us who are old remember the Arab oil embargo, which was triggered by exactly the same thing. The Arab countries thought it'd be clever to invade Israel in, I think, 72, 73, on Yom Kippur, and catch them off guard. They'll all be observing their holiday, and we'll sneak up on it. Well, that didn't go really well. And of course, Israel defended itself, and it actually expanded its zone. And as a result of that, the Arab community, it's not just Arabs, it's the neighborhood, okay? The people in the neighborhood realized that picking a fight with the Israeli army and the Israeli government is a fool's errand, because they're very good and they're very skilled, they're really talented. And so as a result, when that happened, of course, the backlash was the Arab oil embargo. I mean, they invaded, they got kicked, out, and then they lost. And then, okay, what do we do next? Ah, we'll turn off the oil. Well, there aren't a whole lot of cars in Israel, okay? It's just kind of a small place. But the whole idea was, because the United States was backing Israel, that they're and Europe, that by jacking up the oil prices, you're gonna cause suffering in these markets. And it did. I mean, back in the 1970s, it was a real blow to American automobile manufacturing. I remember clearly seeing 1971 and 1972 big Cadillacs, four-door sedans that are like 20 feet long and about 8 feet wide. I mean, these were like living rooms on wheels, They were gorgeous cars, frankly, but it was 8 miles to the gallon if you were lucky. And when that embargo hit and prices of gas went from a quarter a gallon to a dollar a gallon, I mean, it was a quadrupler. The American automobile industry was really shocked and was hit and hit hard. And as a result, they had to retool their automobile production and offer products that were cost effective. And when that happened, there were competitive pressures in the marketplace because you see, the Germans had been working on the Volkswagen, people's car. It was, there's all sorts of, it was before World War II. And of course, there's all the, the Hitler stuff about the Volkswagen. But at the end of the day, Volkswagen was a major producer of cars. And post-war, the idea of having a people's car that was a simple car to operate, low cost, because Europe was still climbing out of World War II's disaster. And they were able to offer this Volkswagen Beetle into the United States market with some very clever marketing that created sort of a status symbol. It was called back then, if you had a Volkswagen, it was a status symbol. It was a second car for American homes because most homes had one car. And suddenly it was cool and fashionable and shishy to drive a Volkswagen Beetle. And it became sort of a cultural icon at first in the 1960s. But by the time the oil embargo hit in the 70s, it really took off. Meanwhile, the Japanese, and Japan is a small island, and of course, there's not a lot of land mass, not a lot of roads, but they made very interesting cars because they were small cars because everything in Japan, the roads and parking places, it's all small. So those companies, Toyota, Honda, were able to come into the American market and take advantage of this gap in time when the big three automakers were like, wow, our 20-foot long, 8-foot wide Cadillac, sedan DeVille, we can't sell any more of these. It opened that door to create for the American automobile industry a huge competitive problem, which is what we see today. If you look at the cars that are offered for sale in America, there's some great cars, Japanese cars, Korean cars, European cars, American cars, and the choice that the American consumer has of what kind of car to buy, from very high mileage to low mileage, big to small. It really diversified
Hello,
that
I'm right now,
market,
and the my.
but it took the problem is that it took, sorry, it's a technical problem. It took I lost my train of thought when Brandon Howes popped in here. What it did is it diversified the market, and it cost the American big three makers tremendously in market share. Had that not happened, the big three in America would be selling a lot more cars. Then and of course it'll still be 20 feet long and 8 feet wide, but it changed the market, and it changed the market that impacted American manufacturing. Now, of course, the American manufacturers have adapted. They're building Buicks in China now. Okay, I mean, the world has grown, the world is a sophisticated place, and corporate manufacturing is a very high-tech business. And of course, everybody's adapted to this global market. But the point is that that embargo not only cost the American consumer a pile of money out of their paychecks to pay more for gasoline to drive to their jobs and drive to the shopping or entertainment or whatever they do, and at the same time, it fundamentally changed how the automobile industry looked globally. Because both the German cars and Japanese cars are excellent products. And you find Mercedes and BMW and Audi and Volkswagen and Toyota and Lexus, same company, Honda, Miata, I mean, and of course the Korean companies, Kia, they have all produced world-class automobiles that are very safe. If you use them properly, they're safe and they're efficient and remarkably clean. When you think about the old cars of the 1960s and 70s, those were not clean burning cars. When you look at internal combustion technology today, these cars are about as clean can be, and they're not perfect, but they are certainly much better off for the environment than the cars of yesteryear. So that oil embargo had a big impact on the globalization of the automobile market. And it was a long digression, but the point is, when we look at the situation in the Middle East, we are seeing the potential for that type of disruptive activity again. Although the question, you know, the analysts that I've spoken with, the question is, it's not just an American and European automobile market buying gasoline and paying too much and hurting the citizens. We now have a much more complex market. We have South American markets. We have, you know, of course, China, huge market. We have even in the Russian economy, and people have cars, and in India. So the question is this oil embargo still a lever to punish Israel and the supporters of Israel, the United States, Europe, or has that come and gone? Is doing that only hurting people who are friendly to your cause? And it's a different world. It's a different market. So we're watching the price of oil. But I did notice that we talk about the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which was set up back in the 1970s. In Louisiana and Texas, the idea being they would blast out these big salt caverns underground near the Gulf, and then they would pump all this oil in. Whenever oil dropped in price, the federal government would buy it and pump it into a hole in the ground. And you'd have this store of the, you know, Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Okay, it was strategic. And of course, the Biden administration has just been emptying this thing. It's right down to like 20% of capacity. Well, now they're starting to frantically pump up. You know, okay, you spent all the strategic reserve to keep gas prices low for political reasons so we could have the 2022 election. But at the end of the day, if things get wild in the United States, where are we with this situation? So it's a convoluted knot, and that's why you watch the oil prices. That's why they didn't shoot through the moon, because it's a much more complex and global problem. And oil, of course, is fungible. It travels around the world. There are refineries in a lot of places. So at the end of the day, and I was going to talk about this yesterday, we looked at how many barrels we still export from the United States, thinking about where is our strategic position with respect to energy? And I'm talking specifically gasoline and diesel fuel, and I suppose jet fuel as well, to keep our mobilized society functioning in times of global crisis. And I think these things have to be negotiated. And I think that's part of the push toward the electric vehicle push. You know, if you can't get oil or gas, and gas is $8 a gallon, you know, are you better off driving an electric car? And then, of course, that's the cost-benefit analysis not only consumers make, but there's a policy decision with respect to oil, because oil just doesn't fall from heaven and gasoline. I mean, this is a whole process, and it's very political, and it's very internationalized. And I think what we want to be thinking about is Americans, is, you know, transportation costs, unless you're willing to walk everywhere or ride a bicycle, you know, or if there's public transportation in your community, and most places don't have that, then maybe it's time to start thinking about mobility as an issue, or get yourself a saddle and learn how to ride a horse, because you may be walking. So we watch that. It's a very interesting thing. The other big story, of course, is the inflation rate reports out today at 3.7% consumer price index. This is tied to it. With continuing pressure on fuel prices, the consumer price index is reported out monthly. And last month it was 3.7. Well, it stayed constant at 3.7. They're expecting last month that it would start to decline, and that's why the Federal Reserve was fiddling around with the interest rates. Well, the core is down from 4.2 to 4.1, which is minus food and energy, but the overall inflation rate is 3.7. So here's the conundrum. The Federal Reserve is raising the interest rates because they want to slow down the economy to slow down inflation, because their theory is that the economy is overheated. And when it's too robust, remember the punch bowl at the party? When the party's roaring a little too loud, if you pull the punch bowl away from the party will calm down. Well, that's the same idea. And what we've been talking about this week, of course, is that as the Federal Reserve is tweaking away over here, you know, adjusting the interest rates by a quarter of a point, the market, and especially in debt, the global markets are saying, you know what, the United States has got real issues. They are broke. They are at $33 trillion in debt, and they've got two more in the pipeline, and the spending is going like crazy, and we want higher interest interest rates than the Federal Reserve is giving us. And effectively, that's what's happening. So the Fed has lost control of that interest rate mechanism, which is the one monetary mechanism they can use to try and control the rate of the economy. So the question becomes, and this is the Hobson's choice, the difficult situation. When the Fed meets in November, you know, they've got the interest rates, you know, where they're set. And the question was, in November, should we raise them again and slow things down? Well, the market's saying, do whatever you want. We want more than you're going to raise it to. And this is the real problem. If they cut the rates to bring the housing market back, because everyone I've talked to, the housing market is at a virtual standstill. You list your house for sale today, it's going to sell because there's so little supply on the market. Demand for housing, even at 8% interest rates. I mean, people have figured out, and these are the late comers. I always think of the parable of the seven wise bridesmaids and seven not so wise, the ones without the oil, the ones with. Well, the ones without have figured out that, you know, the bridegroom's coming, they're going in, they're locking the doors. You better get yourself in that building. And that's where people are right now. The people who are buying either have some subsidy from their company because they're transferring and it's not coming out of their pocket. It comes out of the company's pocket as a cost to move them. That's a rare sliver of people. But for the vast majority of people who want to buy a house, you think, you know what, I better buy whatever's out there, get on the elevator, and we'll refinance later. You know, we're going to take the hit now. It's going to cost a lot of money, so we're going to give up the restaurants and the trip to the vacations and all that. We want to get on that elevator, because if you don't get on that elevator, at some point, you're not going to be anywhere near the elevator to get on. And I think people are realizing that in spades right now. So as the Fed, you know, basically is wrestling with, you know, how do we fight inflation? And that effectively is my three silos, you know, the poor, the middle class, the wealthy. And, you know, the poor gets whacked, and there are a lot of poor people who vote. The Federal Reserve is trying to keep inflation from just reducing their standard of living tremendously. But by doing that, they're effectively creating not only opportunity for the wealthy silo, but how far can you raise interest rates to stop inflation, to protect this silo, when in fact it is crushing the middle silo? And this is the real problem that the Fed has, because there are no good choices. If you raise interest rates to fight inflation, you're just devastating the poor and the middle class. If you lower rates to stimulate the housing market and lower consumer credit card rates for the poor and the middle class, then what you're basically doing is yielding on the inflation battle. And at that point, man, that's when you start to see really big inflation numbers. It's a problem. So we'll see what the Fed does and how they're going to deal with that. So another interesting story I saw today is that they're talking about the U.S. The deficit in federal spending for this year. This is supposed to be $2 trillion. Well, as I dug through the numbers, it was an interesting story that the deficit numbers, and this is how government works. I mean, government budgeting is like nothing any household or business has ever seen. They create an illusion, and then they book the illusion, and then they deal with something, and then the illusion moves over here. This is a perfect example. When President Biden was suggesting that he was going to forgive $379 billion, I'll say $380 billion in student loans, okay? He was going to be generous to 40 million Americans and forgive their student loans. And the people who were stuck with the bills went to the Supreme Court and said, you know, this isn't right. Supreme Court says, no, you can't do that. Okay. Well, they had booked in the federal budget for the federal bookkeeping this $380 billion as an expenditure. And then the court shot it down. So what they do is they take it back out, but they call it a budget cut. And budget cut means politically that's bad, because the people who suffer a budget cut don't get their money from the federal government. And media has a field day with that. It's, oh boy, they cut the budget on $380 billion in student loans are cut. Well, they didn't cut $380 billion in student loans. Nobody got their loans cut. As a matter of fact, they didn't get them forgiven. So by backing the money out of the expenditure, now they're saying it's a budget cut. I think it's not a budget cut. It was, you know, you put it in there early, and when you didn't get what you wanted, and you basically corrected the error. It's a cut. So that becomes a real problem with how the federal government is dealing with our money. And I sort of allude to this from time to time, that we have got to hold the federal government accountable for honest dealings. And I think it's something we need to deal with. Anyway, I'm out of time for today. Thank you so much for tuning in. Have a great afternoon, and I'll talk to you tomorrow. Bye.